You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a beautiful Davis day. I can't say sunny because there's those high clouds up there, but it sure looks nice outside.
The National Weather Service tells me there are decreasing clouds, which is true. I'm looking out the window and I'm west of where Lois is, and it's now sunny here. So it is April 16th, 2025, as we prepare this show for broadcast on April 17, 2025. Temperature right now at the, looks like the Sacramento Executive Airport is 54 degrees, going up to a high today of 70. You know what the high was yesterday? 82. So we're going back into what you might call more normal temperatures for mid-April over the next few days. Tonight's low will be 49 degrees. The last few nights have been 50, 51, 52, which is kind of a magic threshold for summer vegetable garden, but we're dropping down a little bit. Thursday, day of the broadcast, 71 degrees, also decreasing clouds. Thursday night, 47 degrees, mostly clear. Friday, sunny, 77 degrees. Friday night, 47 degrees and clear. Saturday, 77 degrees. Saturday night, 48 degrees and clear. Bumping up a little bit on Sunday to a high of 80 degrees and sunny. That's going to be gorgeous. And then Sunday night will be 51. Monday, 81. Monday night, 50. Tuesday, 81. So a whopping 4-degree difference in the high temperatures over the next few days. Sunny for the rest of the week. We are having some cloudy weather today, and that unfortunately leads us to certain disease and pest problems, which we'll get into as we get a little further into the program. The extended forecast, though, looks like average high temperatures. We've been 5 to 10 degrees above average for the last couple days, which means all of the conversations at my garden center have been...
Is it time to plant tomatoes? Oh, that was the wrong one, wasn't it?
No, that's correct. Is it time to plant tomatoes? Okay, I got a couple of rules for running my own garden center. I don't want tomato seedlings out in the open when it's going to be below 45 degrees. So we were keeping them in the greenhouse, or we were just not bringing them in 2 weeks ago and even a week ago. Now we have the tomato plants outside because the nights are consistently above 45 degrees, but it's only tomatoes that are out there. Where are the peppers? They're in the greenhouse. Where are the eggplants? They're in the greenhouse. And these are little pop-up greenhouses. I don't have a big, fully functioning heated greenhouse. I just have something that gets a lot warmer during the daytime and stays a few degrees warmer at nighttime. And when people come in and they see a sign on the greenhouse, which you're not supposed to go into, that says, pepper and eggplants available in the greenhouse, please ask for assistance. What we're finding is this makes people say, oh, is it a little too cold to plant those yet?
Yes,
that's why they're in the greenhouse.
So, well, that's good. You finally found a way to convince people what you want them to know without being mean about it.
Yeah, the tomatoes are out here, the peppers and the eggplant and the basil are in there because we're concerned about the night temperature. So my rule for those is 50 degrees. They need to stay in the greenhouse when it's 50. I just have to come up with something fairly arbitrary, okay? So I will be bringing in, of course, all kinds of summer vegetables. Temperatures in the upper 70s to 80s this coming weekend. Yeah, we'll have everything you could possibly want with a couple exceptions. First of all, we've been very cautious about bringing in anything in the cucumber family, which includes melons and squash and pumpkins and all that kind of stuff. They're kind of on a spectrum for their tolerance of colder conditions. Cucumbers can take it cooler than other members of the family. Squash, summer squash, zucchini can take it cooler. So we'll probably have some of those out. But you know what? At the end of the day, we're going to put them back in the greenhouse. Why? Because we want them to be a little warmer overnight. As we get further into May, we'll have all kinds of cucumbers and squash and melons and things of that sort. You don't want to put melons into cold soil. And the soil has just almost gotten to 60 degrees. If you go to the CIMIS websites, the soil was at 59 degrees yesterday. 60 soil temperature is our tomato soil temperature. We're looking for 65 for peppers and eggplant, 70 for melons. So we're there for some people. We're not there for a lot of people. And it's a little confusing to explain why. If you have a raised planter, your soil is warmer. You get a soil thermometer, and this is fun. They're not expensive. You get a soil thermometer and go put it in your raised planter bed. You're probably at 65 degrees because it's elevated and it's in direct sun. It warms up more. Those of us who are just out in the open garden, it's just barely getting to 60. Why does that make a difference? Well, the roots going into cold soil will stop growing. They will just stop and the plant will stop growing. That matters less for some things. Tomato plants going into colder soil will just sit, turn kind of purplish, kind of wait for the soil to warm up. Melons going in will stop the new growth and they'll be set back to the point you might as well just put a new plant in 2 weeks later. So planting early is particularly harmful to the heat-loving members of the cucumber family. So I keep having to tell people it's way too early for watermelons. It's a little too early for cucumbers. We're kind of there almost for peppers and eggplant, but holding off is not a bad plan. Your tomatoes are probably fine going in the ground. So that's where we are with summer vegetables. We will obviously talk more about summer vegetables as we get closer in and there's more, you know, things are warmer, but we do have some conversations to have about those. But we also have those public service announcement things that we like to do first. So first of all, KDRT is community radio. It's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. I'm going to diverge from my usual script on that and say, big day of giving is coming up 2 weeks from now, and we would love it on Big Day of Giving, if you would help join the Stampede to donate funds to Davis Media Access and other local nonprofit organizations. And we'll give you more information on that next week because there are all kinds of nonprofits in Davis. I'm in Tree Davis. We're focusing on this. Davis Media Access, which is the parent organization of KDRT, is focusing on it. Every other nonprofit in town is out there. And there's going to be a really simple way for you to donate to all of us. All at once, very simply, you're going to go to the Big Day of Giving website and you can contribute very conveniently to local organizations.
Okay, so we have a spring plant sale coming up. Now, usually we talk about the Arboretum, but this time we have the UC Master Gardeners of Yolo County, and they are going to be Saturday, April 19th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Winters Community Library Teaching Garden. Did you even know they had one? It's at Winters Community Library Teaching Garden, 708 Railroad Avenue in Winters. So I hope you'll join everybody there and get some new plants.
And we also had some information for the Master Gardeners, how to get information about the programs they're doing. You have that in front of you?
So there's this Thursday Zoom workshop schedule. And Mike Cluck sent us to us, and it's wonderful. But, you know, are announcing it each time, it makes it really hard on you all. So I want to tell you that Mary Ellen McKenzie on April 24th is going to do a program on rose care. That's a wonderful thing to know about, but you know what? You should be getting these yourself so you can put them on your own schedule and you don't have to wait for us to announce them. So Joan Tuss from the city is the, from the county, is the person that you would write to get on the mailing list, and her email address. Yes, I'm going to give an email address on the air.
Okay.
joan.tuss@yolocounty.gov.
joan.tuss@yolocounty.gov.
That's it. Wow. And then just ask them to send you the list and there you'll be.
Yeah, they've been doing these Zoom sessions for quite a while, up off and on. And as you say, there's one coming up on rose care. Well, roses are certainly doing their thing right now, so that's very timely. I'm getting lots of questions about problems on roses, but we'll talk. Let's be more positive and talk about other pest problems first. You got another announcement first?
No, I actually have. Usually, I say every week, is it time to plant tomatoes? Well, we already said it's okay to plant tomatoes now. So my new question is, Is it time to turn on the sprinklers?
Oh, yeah, that's a very good question. We have had very little rain, meaningful rain, shall we put it, in March or April. It's been low rainfall since, when was the last major rainstorm we had? I can't even remember now. Yes, it is time to turn on your irrigation system, review your irrigation system. This is really important. I was joking with some of the other residents of my property that basically I spend the month of April walking around fixing drip lines on my farm. That's what I do on my time off, because April, I turn them on. I go down, I take the end off the line of my drip line. I turn on the valve, my well, and I flush through the drip lines. And you would be amazed at what comes out at the other end of a 1,000-foot long line of half inch drip tubing. A pile of calcium deposits that I could scrape up, and it's a cup or two that has formed in those drip lines over the course of the winter, precipitated out from the water that was running through there and is now flushing out to the end. And someday I'll take a picture of this pile of salt, basically, that comes out of each drip line when I do this. If I don't do that on my own drip line, because I'm on a well, that salt will instead try to go out the emitters and will plug them. So first thing I've learned to do on my own property is to flush the drip lines. Let it run for a little while. Let the stuff all come out. When no longer white, powdery, crystalline material is coming out, which is primarily calcium and borax, if you're curious. When that finally is done coming out, I'll put the end back on. And then I get to go out and find all the places that the ground squirrels chewed holes in the line during the course of the winter as well. So that's what I'm doing on my farm. You should be checking your irrigation systems or paying someone to check your irrigation systems before you just turn them on and assume they're still working just as well as they did at the end of the last irrigation season.
So for those of us who don't live in the country and don't have your setup, I have a house and there are various knobs, you know, knees where you can turn on this section and that section.
We call those valves, and it's a manifold. Okay.
A manifold. Okay, fine. Thank you. And, you know, jargon is just jargon. Yeah. So there I am. I'm looking at my yard and there is perhaps a dozen sprinklers, mm-hmm. big ones, not little drip sips, and big ones. I have no idea where the end of that system is. I have no idea how I could take a cap off of something to flush it out. And I've never done it in the 30 years I've lived here.
For a drip system, it's important to do. For a conventional sprinkler system, the orifice size of the sprinkler heads is large enough that that stuff will just usually go right through. So it would be just turning on your regular sprinklers and making sure they're all still working, and, you know, cleaning out heads here and there if they do plug is the important thing to do. For drip, I really do suggest having the end of the line when it's installed accessible so you can flush it out. If you don't, you're probably going to have to replace some of a fair number of the emitters. And in many cases, the emitters are in line, so you can't even replace them. So flushing it through is really important if you can possibly do that. Again, not with conventional sprinklers, but with drip irrigation. So whenever you install, bottom line here, whenever you install a drip irrigation system, make it possible to take off the end and flush it out if you can. If not, you're going to have emitters plugging. And by the way, I have emitters plug in spite of doing all of this because it's not perfect. So the key is to walk along and make sure they're all working. Make sure that the dripper, especially going into containers, I know you have a lot of containers, and if you have a drip system going into containers, typically those are very tiny tubes that are going up into the pot. They plug really easily. Just make sure they're still working. Pretty easy to do. Turn the system on, walk along slowly, and look for the points of where the water is coming out. If it's underground, you've got a problem. You know, some of these Netafim type products are installed underground. You just have to run it and poke around and make sure the water is distributing where it can. And again, for older people, this may be a challenge because you may be having to get down and crawl around under shrubs and things like that to make sure they're properly working. I can tell you how most people do it. They turn on their system at the beginning of the season and they come in to me in July to show me the plants that are struggling because they're not getting water. And it's either because they're not running it long enough or because the emitters aren't working there. Take your pick. So the key is it's April to May. To me, that's time to get your irrigation evaluated. Do it yourself if you possibly can. I really want people to take control of their own irrigation systems. Learn your own timer. If it's too complicated, get one put in that you understand, because you shouldn't have to be calling a landscape technician to come in and change your timer for you. You should understand how to do it yourself. And I really suggest you learn how to bypass your timer and go out and turn the valves on manually, or how to turn the timer on manually so that you can adjust it as we go into heat waves or have periods where you don't need as much water. If people get more comfortable with their own irrigation systems, then when I'm saying things like, oh, look, it's July, but we're having extreme heat, you better bump your water up 10 or 20%. They know exactly what I mean by that. If that's too complicated, then get someone to put in a smart timer. And they're getting surprisingly inexpensive at this point. You might want to do that. If you've been having, if you're in an area where drought restrictions are being put in place frequently, and they're saying, cut your water back 20%, 30%, and you don't know how to do that, then you'll have to pay someone to come in and take care of it. So this is a good time to get to know your timer, check your valves, check your emitters, check your sprinklers and make sure they're covering properly. Measure the output here and there. Maybe sometime in April, set some tuna cans out for your lawn sprinklers and see if you're still getting that inch of water that you're supposed to be putting on, or whether there's parts that are not getting that inch of water. You know, the sprinklers aren't working properly or they aren't overlapping properly, because people waste a lot of water. And I can tell you, if the state does impose drought restrictions, it's typically going to be a 30% reduction across the board. They'll just tell every water district to do that. It's actually really easy to do that. And you don't have to endanger your landscape cutting your water use by 30%, but you first have to have a system that's functioning effectively and efficiently. So that's my lecture for today. Get to know your sprinkler system, and this is a good time to check the emitters and the sprinkler heads to make sure they're working.
I have two questions.
Okay.
The first one is, I do have some drip lines that go into pots, yeah, but they come off of a regular sprinkler head. Mm-hmm. It's like you unscrew the sprinkler head and yeah, you screw this thing in, and then you screw that back on. So it's doing double duty.
Yep.
So that's, I'd still have to check the drip line yeah, heads, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Check the container, make sure that it's still dripping out the end of the small tubing. Yes. Cause that micro tubing just plugs really easily.
And the other question is, if I wanted to replace my current timer with a different timer, it controls like six different manifolds.
Valves.
And yeah, how do I connect when the old one comes out? Does it have things coming in the backside that I haven't seen yet, or is it magic?
I suggest you pay someone to do it.
How do I make okay, that was my question. Pay yeah, someone to change out your thing, but timer, buy one that once they put it in, you will be able to do yourself.
Yeah, there's some really user-friendly sprinkler timers out there. By the way, any listeners out there that have sprinkler timers that you think are really great for the public that are easily changed to increase or decrease water use, if you got a brand you like, jot it down, take a picture and send it to us at davisgardenshow@gmail.com, because I think this is actually a really important topic. More water is wasted by sprinkler systems and timers than by people, because they just set them, they turn them on in April, and they don't change them until November. I have these conversations with people all the time. It would be great if you all would follow the actual water use, the actual ET rate, you know, pattern that we have here, increasing water use going into the summer, decreasing as we get into the fall and so forth, and some fluctuations during the season when we have cooler spells and hotter spells. If you don't know how to adjust it, well, there are timers that will adjust automatically, but even better is to get one that's user-friendly. And they're out there. So again, if you've got a preferred brand, I'm not endorsing something. We're just going to put them out there and say, hey, here's one that you all might look into. davisgardenshow@gmail.com. I just counted recently, 52 valves on my property that I manage manually. 52 valves. I know how many I can run at a given time because I know what my pressure is. And it's just a matter of me walking the line, turning five or six on, five or six off. I'm the timer. I do that because I have the background and I know how long to run them and all that kind of thing. I know that's way too much for most people to do, even in a normal residential setting. So you should have the ability on your timer to do multiple start times on the same day, so that you can really get a good soaking, to adjust as the season goes along to increase or decrease the amount of water coming out. Those are the two main things I would like to see. And if you really want to, if you're on a bigger property, you want to spring for one of the timers that operates off of soil sensors, those are the most efficient and most effective. But there's other types of smart timers out there. And I really think more and more Californians in particular need to go over to sprinkler timers that more efficiently manage their landscape so they can adapt to changing irrigation demands by your local water agency and by the state imposing drought restrictions. We're not in a drought right now. We're going out of El Nino into La Nina. Last two times we've gone into La Nina, we've had droughts. And the state twice now has implemented drought restrictions that simply said, every water agency, cut your water use by X percent. And the water agency says to you, cut your water use by X percent. But the main thing that they say is stop wasting water. Let's go to a more cheerful topic. Fire blight.
No,
you had something else.
No, we are not going to fire blight.
Let's go to something.
So I want to go to a happy topic.
Yeah.
People can plant tomatoes pretty soon, anytime they want.
Yeah, they can start buying
and
them.
They can keep going into May, you know, that's fine. Yep. So the question always comes up, what should they plant? Now, Don created this list that is a document that has his tomatoes from 2024 and the results. Yep. But the list that I have that he gave me isn't complete. So he's going to come with a complete list next time, and this time we're only going to do the real quickie. Don, if you needed to make up, oh, I don't know, a six pack of tomatoes, different kinds of tomatoes, which six would you want to put in?
Yeah, I was kicking this around with actually a tomato friend at one point. You know, we were baffled by the people walking into garden centers looking for six packs of tomatoes. I know you're out there. I know you guys want them, but I have almost no customers who want six of one variety. How many celebrity tomato plants would you actually plant? I mean, but this is what comes up. Why doesn't anybody sell six packs anymore? Well, for very obvious reason that single plants are more profitable, but also single plants are bigger, better root systems, healthier start. And most of you don't need six. Who would plant a six pack of cherry tomatoes?
No, so, we want six different.
Right.
Tomatoes.
So the idea was we should come up with a mixed six pack. And in fact, someone sent me a picture where they saw a mixed three pack being sold at one of the big chains, Walmart, or, you know, one of those types of places. What a brilliant idea. You know, six different varieties. So it would be challenging for me to come up with the exact six, but you know that rugby would be in there because I've been touting that one for what, 5 years now. It's a phenomenal producer. Bodacious would be in my six pack, no question. Chef's Choice Orange would be in my six pack with no question. Principa Borghese would be in my six pack because that's such a great little meaty cherry tomato for sun drying and sauces and things like that. And that's four of the six. And then I would put in two fairly random things to just broaden the, you know, diversify the portfolio. With Rugby, you've got a sauce tomato that slices well. With Bodacious, you've got one that slices well. That's a classic red tomato. Chef's Choice Orange is a big orange 1 pound fruit that slices great. And you've got something for cooking with the Principa Borghese there. So why not throw in, if you're a family that likes cherry tomatoes, and you're going to probably want Sun Gold because that's by far the most popular cherry tomato. Well, there's five, and I would leave room for one heirloom. And if I were choosing one heirloom that has been consistent for me, it's Cherokee Purple. So there's your six pack.
Early Girl isn't in there.
That's correct. It's not in there. I like Early Girl, and there is no question I would plant an Early Girl, but it wouldn't be in that six pack necessarily. And by the way, I'm shifting to New Girl. New Girl's been outperforming Early Girl in my garden for the last 3 years. So I'm going to do it again this year, side by side comparison, and take pictures. I'm going to do a seasonal progression of New Girl and Early Girl so you can see the difference. They're both very good. Early Girl is certainly still an outstanding tomato, but you're right. It wouldn't necessarily have been in my six pack because I'm trying to broaden the portfolio there, diversify your portfolio.
How late can you plant New Girl?
August.
Oh, I like every that
year,
answer.
Every year I push the boundary 2 weeks. So a few years ago, I planted some tomatoes on the 1st of July, and they did so well. But, you know, a huge harvest in October. Okay, next year I did July 15th. Last year I planted four tomatoes on August 1. August 1. Two heirlooms and two hybrids. Each of them produced 20 to 30 tomatoes by October, planted on August 1. So they were put in, obviously, they needed water every day when you're planting in the middle of August. So they went on the line that my peppers and things are on, the line that runs almost every day. They didn't go on the tomato line, which is deep, less frequent watering, because I just, you know, didn't want to put four little seedlings on a line with big mature tomatoes and try and water them the same. But I put them in August 1, and they produced 20 to 30 fruit by October. And a couple of those, one of them was the one that I'll mention, It's a Keeper. It's a keeper, which holds really well. It's a very firm, solid tomato. And my friend Fred and I, who swap notes on this, we're still looking at those on our counters, looking perfectly good in December. So It's a Keeper is one to look for. You may have to get the seed from Seeds and Such online, or certain nurseries in the Davis area actually sell it. It's a really good late producing variety that holds really well. I mean, that would be the second six pack, would be Early Girl, It's a Keeper. Shall we keep going? Our 12, now we're at a 24 pack.
So Don has a chart on his website that is called Edibles by Month.
Yeah.
And it's when can you harvest things to eat out of your garden or off your trees or whatever. And I'm going, well, we're just planting things now. There's not gonna be anything to harvest, is it? I looked it up, I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. April, there's a whole bunch of citrus. Oh, well, that makes sense because, you know, that's when citrus do their thing. But then vegetables, they had beets and carrots and greens and peas and radishes. So yeah, you those can harvest all the time.
Those are things you would have been planting between October and early February. And you would be harvesting in April to May. And now we have people coming in asking about things like peas, for example. You should be beginning to pick peas. I don't know if they're on that list, but it's too late to plant them. And here's the thing, they would come up, they would grow, they would just be flowering, but we'd start to hit 90 degrees and that would be the end of it. So the things you would be harvesting now are things that were planted in the cool season. We always have lots of people new to the Davis area. We've got a big university here. People come here and settle in and start gardening, and they move here from all over the world. And they're always a little surprised when they see those things in nurseries in October, November, if they've come from a colder climate, thinking, how could you possibly be selling these? They're just going to freeze. No, these are things that we plant for the cool season. And you're harvesting typically, April is a pretty big harvest period for those root vegetables that you mentioned, for example. And the leafy greens are still producing, although many of them are flowering. So I have kale in my backyard, for example, that's in bloom. All right, that's okay. I don't care. But there's also kale that still could be harvested and eaten. It's too late to plant kale. It's not something that's going to go into the hot weather. So we have very distinct seasons here for cool season vegetables and warm season vegetables. And we're starting to plant the warm season vegetables while we're enjoying the harvest of the cool season vegetables.
All right. So the next thing I want to talk about is something that we've talked about many a time, but Don wants to just really quick go through it because it's small trees. Yeah. And there's no caveat. This isn't the for the shade or for the sun. It's just all small trees divided into deciduous and evergreen. So let's do deciduous first. Go for it, Don.
Well, let me also explain where this is coming from. A lot of people moving into a couple of new subdivisions in the area, and they're very dense housing. There are small houses on small lots. It's kind of a seniors community, and they're walking, and they have solar panels in every house. Every house in California that goes in now has to have solar panels. So they're coming in asking for trees, and then it turns out they really can't plant anything that gets more than about 15 or 20 feet tall. So that's a large shrub, but there are some small trees, and these are the ones we keep coming back to. So I just wanted to go through them quick. You can think about them. You'll find lists on my website and the city website and other places of these. But real quickly, Oklahoma redbud. My goodness, there's a lot of them around Davis now. They were spectacular over the last 3 to 4 weeks. Those are the Oklahoma redbud, not the Western redbud. If it's shaped like a tree, it's Cirsus canadensis, Oklahoma. We talked about that one last week. Really popular, great tree for this area. It takes drought and watering. Desert willow, which is Chilopsis, becoming very popular. Smoke bush or smoke tree, Cotinus cogigria purpureus, which has really pretty purple foliage. Nice alternative to that red leaf or purple leaf plum. Crepe myrtles, but we're always looking for substitutions for crepe myrtles now because the crepe myrtle aphid has become a big problem, but there's still places where crepe myrtles will be fine. Just be aware there's going to be sticky drip under the tree. Pomegranate. What? Pomegranate? That's a fruit tree. Yeah, it's a great tree. Incredibly heat and drought tolerant. Beautiful tree. More like a giant shrub than a tree. It's very hard to keep it with a single trunk, but they get 12 to 15 feet and they have nice fall color and the fruit's a nice bonus and the flowers are pretty and they're incredibly drought and heat tolerant, as I mentioned. And there's also fruitless kinds. If you happen to want all those benefits without the fruit, there's some really pretty flowering pomegranates. And the last one I'll mention is really more of a large shrub, but it's sold and used as a tree. Chaste tree. Vitex agnus castus, which has beautiful blue flowers the same season as crepe myrtles and is a very similar type of thing. 12 to 15 foot range, bushy, more than single tree trunk, deciduous and really pretty blue flowers in the summertime.
And if you want to see a white version of that chaste tree, you can go to the senior center, and at the entrance, there is one in a giant pot.
Yeah. Vitex leaves. Go ahead. Vitex leaves are palmate. They kind of look like cannabis, actually. There have been some amusing incidents when kids have stolen them and smoked them. It doesn't have any effect, just for the record. It's a big, leafy, attractive, blue-flowered, large shrub or small tree.
You do know why it's called a chaste, C-H-A-S-T-E.
Yes, suppresses tree. Libido, so they say. So that's the amusing part of people stealing them and smoking them.
Yeah. So then we have some evergreen small trees, and do you want to read those off?
Yeah, it's interesting how people are using evergreens more. When you get into the small tree category, having an evergreen is not as daunting as, say, a giant pine or something might be. These don't overwhelm your yard. Probably the biggest of the batch is the Marina variety of arbutus, close relative of our native madrone, but much, much more adaptable. Ultimately, potentially 30 to 40 feet, but that's many, many, many years down the road. Most of the people are keeping them at about 15 feet with no problem. So arbutus, Marina. Citrus, of course, are evergreen trees, and they range from 8 to 20 feet, depending on the type you get, how you train it and prune it. You got the benefits of fragrant blossoms, nice fruit, easy to grow, relatively speaking, pretty drought tolerant, actually. Feijoa siloiana, or Acca siloiana, the pineapple guava, which is, again, a big shrub, but we can train it as a tree. Edible flowers, edible fruit, attractive and extremely heat and drought tolerant. Of the bays, we have a native bay, which no growers do in Northern California. The umbellularia is simply not grown for a disease reason. But the Mediterranean bay is very popular and can get big, 30 to 40 feet. But the Saratoga cultivar has a rounder head, naturally more tree-like, very aromatic foliage, and incredibly tough tree. A figure 20 by 20 without any special training. I'll mention olives. I mean, they're incredibly heat and drought tolerant. Fruitless ones are not truly fruitless, but they're close. They have limited fruit production. There is one that is fruitless called Swan Hill, which is a weak grower. I don't really recommend it. But the thing about olives, they can take zero irrigation once established. They're incredibly heat and drought tolerant. So they're a great choice if you happen to not mind the pollen and like that look. And then the last one we sell a lot of is the so-called fern pine, one of my favorite common names because it illustrates how pointless many common names are. Podocarpus gracilior, fern pine, not a fern, it's not a pine, so we call it a fern pine. Podocarpus gracilior is a really soft looking, almost willow-like leaf. It's an evergreen. It's got a very rounded crown when it's established, but it's very commonly grown as a columnar plant in the narrow spot between houses because it's very prunable. You can turn it into a hedge if you want to. And it's got this sort of delicate appearance, but it's actually a very tough plant. If you want something more solid and darker green, there's another Podocarpus called Henkeli, which is even more substantial. These are both 20 to 30 foot typically in our area, but easily kept lower than that by pruning. So just a few smaller trees for smaller yards where you might have solar panels or a neighbor who doesn't want shade on theirs. They're, you know, from your trees, or you just have a patio or something like that. These have become very popular choices. And one of the things that keeps coming up is that people walk in asking for crepe myrtles, which are the classic small to medium tree that have been planted by the tens of thousands around the Sacramento Valley. I mean, there's probably 10,000 of them in Davis alone. They're so widely popular. But with the crepe myrtle aphid well-established, causing a sticky drip under the crepe myrtles, people are looking for alternatives. So that's what some of these would certainly do. They would fill the bill of a small crepe myrtle replacement for a patio or a small yard or a place where you have solar panels and you can't let anything get more than about 15 to 20 feet.
All right. So we have a question that's come in. And this person in Davis writes, our parkway on the other side of the sidewalk is an eyesore after a tree removal, adding three trees and now general patchiness of the grass. We would like to try something else there and maybe later would use the same thing to replace at least some of the main front lawn. Our handyman who would do this work was wondering about using drought tolerant clover. Oh. Is this something you would recommend? What suggestions do you have for low effect, low water use, attractive options? It's somewhat shady, but gets afternoon sun.
This kind of question comes up a lot. First of all, this is the sidewalk, what landscapers like to call the hell strip. So this is the place between the sidewalk and the street, which may or may not have
irritation. Oh, the death zone.
Yeah, well, you could call it that if you, I assume that's what they're talking about here.
Yes, it is.
The other side of the sidewalk. Yeah. And these are challenging because in some parts of Davis, for example, when they were put in, a water line was run to them. In other parts, it wasn't. So it's like bare soil surrounded by concrete and asphalt, usually fully exposed to sun and heat and no irrigation. That's a short list of plants that will take that, but there are plants that will take that. These, you should really get creative with these because you're going to have a lot of problems that will just frustrate you if you don't take these things into consideration. There's going to be foot traffic. There's going to be bikes going through there that are going to just cut right over if they can. People are going to be walking on the sidewalk. They'll step off onto this. People who park on the street will walk across this zone to get to your house. Plan for that. Plan for where people are going to cut through. Always assume that people will take the shortest path distance and don't put a plant there if you care about it. Or if you do put a plant there, make it an obstacle, like a barberry, something they're not going to walk through. Not that I'm recommending that, but something substantial like that. So bear in mind that traffic is going to be a factor. Lack of irrigation is going to be a factor. So getting to the first comment by the handyman, the clovers that are being touted for this purpose are not as drought tolerant as they seem to be suggesting. They're more drought tolerant than your grass. They can come back from drought better than a lot of types of turf, but they'll look really, really stressed if you don't irrigate them. So that they would need to be irrigated in this zone, and you'd have to probably drag a hose out there in order to do it, unless the handyman can get under the sidewalk with a water line, which is not that hard to do, and get a drip line or something in there. So bear in mind that clover, despite being touted as drought tolerant, is not that drought tolerant. Also, when it's in bloom, it's very attractive to bees. I think that's cool. I have no problem with the fact that bees would be coming there. But if you, as I know these people do, have dogs, that could be an issue. If you have kids that like to play on this, well, this is the zone by the street, so probably not. But if that's a concern, be aware. Clover is popular because it's attractive to bees. So that's something to keep in mind. In general, though, we're getting to the point with these lawn replacement and difficult places like this. Don't just settle on one plant. I can't tell you how many times I've talked to people who have gone that route. I'm going to put in creeping thyme. I'm going to put in diamondia. I'm going to fill this with this type of fescue. And well, it works okay in part. It doesn't work in another part, or it just dies out after a couple of years. Mix plants. Have, just like when we're talking about hedge plantings at here on the Davis Garden Show, diversity is your friend here. If you need a bunch of different types of things, yes, you should repeat something. You should have some things for design continuity. But rather than just doing the whole thing in clover and then finding out it didn't work out, I'd suggest clover is fine, but also clumps of fescue and maybe some dianella and possibly some lomandra. These are all grassy looking plants. Maybe where you want to actually block people from walking through, one of the semi-dwarf size formiums, the flax plants, but get one that only gets 3 to 4 feet, not one of the 6 to 8 footers. There are shrubs that will take these conditions as well. And so a mix of species that can tolerate a little bit of traffic, intermittent drought, a range of sun to shade, I think is going to be a better, safer bet in the long run than just taking one thing and trying to plant that in the whole zone. I have no problem with the clover because you can do it from seed. So if he's wanting to go out and buy a few pounds of this micro clover is probably what he's talking about. Fine, go for it. It will need daily watering while it's getting established. My experience from customers who have done this, their feedback is it's slow to get going. It's slow to make a cover and a lot of weeds come up at first. Good news with clover, you can actually mow it. So if a bunch of weeds come up, go ahead and take a string line trimmer or a mower, set it as high as you can and mow it occasionally to kill out a lot of those weeds, assuming that they're annual types of weeds. Bring in samples to me or take pictures and bring them to me. If you're listening elsewhere, send those to us at davisgardenshow@gmail.com. Because if Bermuda grass comes up or morning glory or nut sedge, you'll need to probably use a chemical approach to those, or you'll need to bury them until they're gone. So if you have perennial weeds, that could be an issue. But just be aware that there's a period of establishment. Usually the first spring and summer, you spend a lot of time managing the weeds that come up and getting this established. That's fine. For a big part of it, I'm absolutely okay with that. But put something else in there as well. Because I just have found that when people settle on the one thing, and then it doesn't work out, they're awfully disappointed. Whereas if the clover fills the corners and the margins, and a bigger plant's in the middle, and you got some step stones where people are likely to walk through, and you can artfully put in a few flowering perennials, then gradually you find yourself adding some shrubs, and pretty soon you have made your front hellscape the envy of the whole neighborhood by putting in diversity of species and figuring out what works. And here's the thing. When something works, increase it. I know this is a really simple principle of horticulture and design. When something works, do more of it. When something doesn't work, don't struggle with it. And I'm coming back to you, creeping time, because you're usually the one that people try. Just dies out after a couple of years. Okay, put something else in that is compatible with it that will replace it. Delosperma is blooming all around town right now. Gazanias are in full bloom right now. Those are really tough plants for these kinds of zones. And so there's something that you could add with the clover. And if that happens to be the one that gradually dominates, great. Just go with what works.
I'm thinking about maintenance. You know, that's always a challenge for me.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about, there are a whole lot of beautiful daylilies. There's lots of different colors and kinds, and some are little and some are big. And if you were to just put down arborist wood chips with daylilies every once in a while, that would be beautiful. People could step on it. And if you did it properly, the wood chips wouldn't wash away.
Yeah, daylilies would certainly fit in something like this. And you've got, you don't have to do the whole zone in them, but there's a whole lot of dwarf ones that have come on the market. Ever since the extraordinary success of the variety called Stella d'Oro, a little 1 foot golden blooming dwarf daylily that blooms, the joke is 362 days a year. It takes three holidays off. It's never out of bloom. It's in bloom middle of the winter. It came on the market 40 years ago, and it began to sell like crazy. I mean, daylily suppliers would give you a discount if you bought 100 of them. People were mass planting it. It works great for things like this. It never stops blooming. It can look a little rough in extreme heat. This is important to know about daylilies here in the valley. Those of you listening in other parts of the country where you don't hit 100 degrees on a regular basis during the summer, this may not affect you. But here, as we get into July, daylilies, even those that are blooming all the time, like the dwarf ones, like Stella d'Oro, look rough. The foliage can look kind of stressed, but it's a great mass planting thing for the corners and the edges, or right along where people might be walking through, a couple step stones surrounded by Stella d'Oro. Well, it was so successful that there's a bunch of others, Cranberry Baby, Black-Eyed Stella. I mean, there's a bunch of 1 foot daylilies that will do exactly what Lois is describing, giving that spot of color over a very long period of time. If you want to block people, there's big daylilies. There's some that get 2 to 3 feet tall and bloom up 4 feet. So if you have a place where you want a more substantial plant, certainly there's bigger, and the tetraploid, the huge flower daylilies would be a possibility as well. I wouldn't do the whole thing in them because they can look a little rough in July. So make sure there's something in there that looks good midsummer. And of course, you know, even though these are mostly evergreen daylilies, they're not looking at their best in December, January. So try to have something grassy in there that looks good then. There's some of the reeds and sedges that look really good in the winter. There's the Acorus, which is a sedge-like plant that's got golden foliage, one called Ogon, which looks very attractive December, January, February. It's shiny gold when everything else is looking rough and dormant. So some of that right around the edges or along the steps would also be useful. So there's a whole lot of plants in this leafy, grassy leafed accent category, which can be either solid ground covers or just in little groups of 3 to 5, can be artistically arranged. And just try to make sure you get something that covers those off seasons, the midsummer, the midwinter, when otherwise things tend to look pretty rough. There's a lot of grasses, for example, that would work great, but the vast majority of ornamental grasses are deciduous. So they look kind of scruffy here in December, January, February. They can really fill nicely as you get into the summer months. So keep some of those in mind as well.
So I happen to know the property that she's talking about.
Yeah, same here.
And
yeah.
I believe that it's high shade. I mean, really, really tall trees. So it's bright shade, but it's still not full sun.
Right.
And all of the things you're talking about, would they do okay in shade?
In that kind of shade, yes. These are older neighborhoods. If those of you in Sacramento know Land Park or the fabulous 40s, places like Miller Drive and College Park in Davis, where there's old 80, 90-year-old trees that are way up high. And so it's bright. The sun does peek through here and there. And some of these older neighborhoods, as they indicate here, some of those trees are going away now. They've gotten old and been taken out. So now new trees have been put in. Well, it's going to be 5 to 10 years before those new trees are giving significant shade. So you'll have to adjust for that as time goes by. All the grasses and things would be fine with that kind of high, bright shade. If you're in a place where it's a lot more shade, you know, where you're just not getting any sun at all, there are ground cover plants that'll take that. There's turf lilies, the Liriopora liriope, the mondo grass. Some of the things like dianellas and some of the sedges I mentioned would actually be fine in that situation as well. You'll have to experiment a little bit, but high shade is pretty adaptable. And there's one group of plants that I highly recommend you consider in this. That is bulbs, flowering bulbs, daffodils, narcissus, tulips, things like that will be very happy in a zone like this. Most of them are extremely drought tolerant. Bulbs are generally a drought adaptation, so they would fit very nicely. So little groups of flowering bulbs. One thing I would suggest, you know, this is sounding a little complicated, so let's not make it too difficult. Plants should be 3 to 4 feet apart, a little bit open between them so that you can get in and manage the weeding. Things that are in mass planting should be in groups of 3 to 5. Try to break it up a little bit with maybe some rocks or some bigger accent plants in there. Just diversify it as much as you possibly can, but have a repeating pattern. This is how designs work best, is where there's a repeating pattern of certain plants through the whole garden area. So if you take that Acorus ogon and you use it, you don't just put in one little tuft of it. You put in 7 groups of 3. In different parts all down this border. And then they're with another plant that they're always complementing. It's pretty easy to come up with these things. A good garden center can help you with this. A designer could be very helpful. So that's the kind of thing where you might actually want to talk to a landscape designer who will sketch it out for you, make up a plant list, and the clover could certainly be part of that.
Naked ladies, Don. Naked ladies.
Absolutely. Amaryllis belladonna would fit right in this. Daffodils would fit right in it. Tulip clusiana, the little botanical tulip that I saw one of these hell strips in on 11th Street where my kids were working, choked with lady tulip, the tulip clusiana. Someone had planted there 30, 40 years before. It multiplies in this area. That was all that was in that area. And when it was in bloom in the spring, it was spectacular. I would suggest, you know, balancing that with something that looks good the rest of the year, but there are bulbs that would fit beautifully in this. And Amaryllis belladonna is a classic example, something that would just take care of itself, have foliage during the growing season. Blooms pop up in late summer is a really nice, pleasurable thing to complement the grasses and the sedges nearby.
So, Don, I know that this is fire blight season.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about that? What do we need to know about fire blight?
Well, fire blight hit 3 days ago. We always say 55 to 82 degrees, and apparently 51 or 50 degrees was fine with fire blight this year. It's a bacterial disease that attacks members of the rose family, specifically the apple division of the rose family, and particularly apples, pears. Pears are among the worst. And then pyracantha and hawthorns and certain other plants can also get it. Loquat is another example of a plant that can get it very badly. 3 or 4 days ago, I checked my pear trees and I have a couple of varieties that are susceptible and it hit. And a lot of the blossoms have been blighted. Some of the fruit has been blighted, although a fair bit of it looks like it's going to get through. It's a bacterial disease. So if you go into a store and they sell you a fungicide, fungicides don't work on bacteria. So they're not going to work. There is no spray that home gardeners, in my opinion, can reasonably use for fire blight that's going to give good results. So you basically just, as with many diseases, wait and see. And as with most diseases, it has anywhere from a 2 to 6 week period of infection and injury. And then we get through that. We get above 85 degrees, which is the upper temperature range for fire blight, and it stops infecting. And then you can look at your tree and assess the condition. If it's a very susceptible tree, like 20th century Asian pear, for example, you may have 50% of the blossoms blighted. You might still still get fruit, but it could have done so much damage that you're just not going to get much. Other varieties like Shinko, Hosui don't get it as badly. European pears, Bartlett gets it so badly, I strongly recommend never planting Bartlett pear. What's the top-selling pear at garden centers in the United States? Bartlett. So your problem is that nurseries are selling the one that is very, very, very susceptible to fire blight. So your basic approach before you've put a tree in the ground is to look for resistant varieties. In the case of pears, get Warren or Fanstill or Moonglow. Those are resistant to fire blight. If you have it, and it happens on your crab apple or your pear or your apple, what I do is I just wait. We get through the season and we get into May and June. We're well past any likelihood of a further infection. And at that point, you can go out. It's really obvious where it infected because all those parts, points of infection are dead. You prune them out. You prune down into healthy green wood. You put that in a plastic bag. It goes out with the trash. And you do that each season. Some years it's worse than others. And so you just prune out whatever you can after fire blight infection season. I know you want to do something now. I know you want to go out and buy a spray. There is no spray. I know you want to prune now. Okay, you can, but I think it's probably better to wait until after the infectious period and just prune out once we're through that period. In the long run, your best bet is to look for resistant varieties or just be aware that it rarely kills a tree, but there's really nothing to do during the period of infection. If you wait until summer, and you see all these 20, 30 points of infection, then you can just casually prune them out as you walk by. You know, you don't, there's no urgency to it at that point. It's not going to reinfect. So you go out there and you prune some out. You have to get a ladder out. You prune some more out. You got all summer to take care of it. Just get that out of there if you can, because those infected points will, you know, reinfect next year when we get to that magic 55 to 82 degree period. Fire blight's frustrating. Resistant varieties are your best answer. If you go online, someone's going to tell you to go out and spray antibiotics. Streptomycin is what is used commercially for managing fire blight on pears and apples. Do I really think home gardeners should be spraying streptomycin on their fruit trees? 15 to 20 years of commercial orchards doing it has led to streptomycin fire blight resistant, fire blight strains that are resistant to streptomycin, which is what happens when you use one product over and over again. And you can't buy that at a garden center. You can't buy that at a hardware store. You'd be going to an ag supply place. The best bet is to avoid it by planting the right kinds in the first place and prune it out after the infectious period. That's the bottom line on fire blight. I know it's awful. It's a horrible disease to see. And I'm sorry you're not going to walk out of my garden center with a product in hand for it, but there really isn't a product that works on it. So if you all have heard of something that you think works, again, send us notes at davisgardenshow@gmail.com. I've dug into this as best I can, and I don't find anything out there that's an easy control measure for people. But be aware, like almost every disease, it has a limited temperature range. We get through it, we see how bad it was, and then we deal with it.
Don, I want to talk about something that's bright and cheerful and happy.
Okay.
So I'm going to ask you, what's blooming at your house right now? It's the middle of April.
Roses. This is the peak bloom period for all my roses, and I have so many rose bushes out there that it's absolutely spectacular. You get home, you throw your briefcase by the front door, and you walk out to look at the roses. Decompress that way. The roses are spectacular right now. And I have a lot of interesting kinds. I have a lot of roses that only bloom in the spring, so that's, I really like to go out and enjoy those right now. I have a lot of 19th century heirloom roses. I have one called La Reine Victoria, which is a bourbon rose. It goes back to the early part of the 19th century. And it probably has 500 blooms on it right now that are powerfully, powerfully fragrant. If you've got room for the old-fashioned roses, I highly recommend you get into them because their fragrance is amazing, but the plants are generally a lot bigger than what you're expecting. But that's what's in bloom. That's the main thing that's in bloom right now, not to mention, oh, the pear trees, the cherries are still blooming. As you walk around on the property, you'll see Eleagnus are blooming, which is a plant that you don't see the flower, but you smell it 50 yards away. Super, super fragrant blooms on my Eleagnus. That's just a sampling of what's in bloom right now.
Well, I have Queen's Tears blooming. And for those folks who don't know Queen's Tears, I suggest you go Google it and look at those flowers and you will be astonished or disbelieving, one of the two.
Teal blue with pink, I think is the
and
word.
And yellow and green. Yeah. I mean, it's this incredible structure and these vibrant colors, and it's small.
Yeah, this is a house plant or outdoor plant for us. Bilbergia nutans, if you don't know it by the common name. And here we can actually grow it outside in the shade. In colder climates, they grow it strictly as a house plant. And when it blooms, it's one of those unbelievable colors. It's really very interesting and very tough, easy to grow. Hardly any nursery sells it because it's the kind of plant that you get from your neighbor. It's an over-the-fence plant, very easy to grow. Queen's tears.
And you know what's about to bloom when you're lovely, very modest looking green strappy leaves suddenly puts up this bright pink stalk.
Yes. taffeta pink, I believe, is the term for it.
So, Don, I want to ask you what else you're doing. What are you growing from seed these days?
Oh, April. The end of March through April is a very active seed planting period, both for me as a gardener and also for us at our garden center. So we're beginning to start zinnias right now, for example. Now, isn't this late? No, zinnias like heat. We don't even begin planting the seeds of zinnias until the middle of April. They will come up very quickly. Zinnias, asters, sunflowers, we all do. We do them directly in whatever pot we're going to sell them in because they grow so quickly. We start planting them in mid-April and we plant them out in the garden in May. These are plants that really like it warm. Cosmos is another good example. So those are some of the things we're getting started now from seed. Personally, I'm planting just because of how spectacularly successful they've been for me. Nicotiana, the ornamental tobacco. If you want a plant that gives you a lot of bang for your buck, folks, anything in that genus, Nicotiana, flowering tobacco. I have plants now that are blooming that I planted 3 years ago from seed. It reseeds itself. It comes back as a perennial and it blooms every month of the year. Yes, it is nicotine. So it is toxic. Don't eat it. But something that's very, very, very easy from seed. A couple others that I have found very easy directly seeded into pots. I don't do things out in the ground because I just am feeding wildlife when I do that. I do them in pots first, then I transplant them out. Sunflowers, of course, I've mentioned those. Scabiosa, the pincushion flower, both the perennial and the annual forms, we have found very, very easy to grow from seed. It's something that you can plant directly in a large container or in small pots to transplant out, whether you like the old-fashioned ones for cutting or the perennial types that are great garden plants. As a group, I find Scabiosa among some of the easiest plants to grow. Personally, I'm about to plant one of my favorite groups of plants in pots to plant out when it's warmer, Celosia. Celosia. There's three forms. There's the plume flower, Celosia. There's the crested form, which are sold as coxcomb because they have a crested head that looks like a brain. Honestly, those are really cool. And then there's a spike form that I planted 3 years ago that's making me a little nervous by how much it's reseeding, which is fine with me, but you might want to think about this before you plant it in your yard. Celosias love heat. They love a hot, dry climate. They're incredibly easy to grow here. Along with amaranthus and plants like that, they can make a spectacular mid to late summer border along with those giant Bennery zinnias that you're going to all be planting this year as well. So good time to start putting in pots and getting ready to plant out in the garden. The summer-loving, heat-loving, flowering plants. And we're also planting, of course, cucumbers, melons, things like that to plant out further into May and June.
So as we close the show, I want to remind you, this really isn't a humorous garden quote. This is a much more serious garden quote.
Okay.
Because we're doing lots of planting because it's spring. It's, you know, when planting new plants, remember, check daily, water as needed.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.